Okay, so let's continue. So we were talking about Lagrangians for vector superfields, and so let me just remind you where we were. Vector superfields. We had the case of a super QED, in which the Lagrangian was just a phi dagger e to the minus qv times phi, and the q is just plus d term plus w of phi f term plus a constant tau that we can always absorb in the Lagrangian, and that is W alpha . Okay, so we had, this was our Lagrangian for a super QED, and then what is useful after that is to write the Lagrangian in terms of components, that's as we did for the case of just chiral superfields. So let's do that in components. Phi dagger into the QV phi D term. I'm sorry, I forgot one piece. Which was the Fajeria plus term. Remember that I mentioned at the end. Okay, so in components, this first part will be F times F star plus d mu phi star plus I psi bar sigma mu bar mu d mu psi plus q d mu, better use the other line. So plus, let me just write it here. It will be long, so I better start writing here. Q d mu psi bar sigma bar mu psi plus I over 2 phi star mu phi minus I over 2 phi d mu phi star plus I over root 2 q factor of phi lambda bar psi bar minus phi star lambda psi plus 1/2. Sorry about this. It's a bit long. Q over 2 d plus mu d mu phi square, where to get to this expression, notice that we have an exponential of v. So an exponential of a superfield looks completely hopeless, because it's a superfield is complicated, so the exponential is. But for doing this, what I'm doing is I'm using the Wessel-Minow gauge. And for the Wessel-Minow gauge, remember that the v squared was very simple and v cubed was zero. So the exponential then stops at the v squared. So for this, I have used, well, yes. So we have used the Uesumino gauge, okay, in which V to the n greater than 3 was greater or equal than 3 was 0. So then the exponential is very easily controlled. And that is the power of the Uesumino gauge, that we can write something that makes sense. Notice that this Lagrangian is precisely what we expected for QED. I could have written it even in a shorter way, but I wanted to be explicit. So notice we have the standard kinetic term for the scalar field, kinetic term for the fermion field. But this is a gauge theory, so it has to come out in terms of covariant derivatives. And the covariant derivatives actually come here. I could have written just covariant derivative of phi and covariant derivative of psi, because notice that we have the coupling of V sigma psi. This will be the thing that would enter into the covariant derivative. And also the term V mu d mu phi that will enter into here. Okay? And the same for this one. So all this term, what this term is doing is just completing these two terms as covariant derivatives. Okay? The mu's can be completed as d mu's. From the term okay. So and from this term also, okay, this is v mu is also part of the covariant derivative. So essentially we have the whole Lagrangian can be written in a simple way, just FF star, covariant derivatives of phi, covariant derivatives of psi, and then plus the coupling of phi lambda and psi, which are kind of a couplings of a scalar to the corresponding fermion and Gugino. This is the Gugino, how the Gugino couples to the chiral components of the chiral superfield, and the D term. Okay, so those are the points I wanted to make clear. So we have it's nice that this way of covariantizing in a supersymmetric way gives you in components the standard covariantization of the derivatives in the component Lagrangian. It had to be because both are ways to impose the Lagrangian to be gauge invariant. Okay. Good. That was the part for phi dagger phi, but I told you that it has other, this other two parts. I will skip this for the moment, because W of phi, well, let me just do it. W of phi, that will be equal to zero if only one chiral superfield. Because if it is charged, it will not be invariant under the gauge transformations. Or, well, if it be a constant, but the constant is irrelevant. And if we have several of them, then it will not be zero, because then you can have combinations which are chargeless. Sorry? Yeah? A question? No question. Okay, so this, and in any case, this will not give us anything new from what we had before, because here the superpotential only depends on the chiral superfields and not on the vector superfields. So whatever we had before applies here, except that now we have to impose that the superpotential has to be invariant under the corresponding gauge transformation. Okay, so we took W. Now let's see what happened to this field strain superfield. That equals 1/2 d squared, where remember d is the d term of the vector superfield, minus 1/4 f mu nu. And let me just write this as the whole thing tau. Then so here I can write the real part of tau. No, it is zero because imagine phi has to be invariant under the transformation, under the gauge transformation. So any power of phi, phi is not invariant. Phi transforms under the gauge transformation. So any power of phi will transform. The only way to get something invariant is to multiply phi by another superfield. Sorry, I changed my mind. I better write this without the tau because it's cumbersome. Sorry about that. Otherwise, it would be more complicated. Plus I lambda sigma mu d mu lambda. Sorry?
You mean only one power of phi?
Any power. Take phi and transform as with a phase, or say. Then any power of phi will transform with another phase, but they are never invariant. Because remember, the important thing on the superpotential is that it's holomorphic. You cannot have phi and phi bar together. So you cannot, if phi transforms under the gauge transformation, you cannot make it into an invariant object. Imagine just have phi transforming it as a phase, phi squared transforms e to the 2i times the phase, and phi to the n transforms e to the 2i n times the phase. And so it is not invariant. So what you need to have w to be invariant. So the whole Lagrangian has to be invariant. And so the only way...
But you said you wanted invariant if there's only one phi.
If there's only one phi, so the only thing that is invariant is zero, or constant. Yes. Then you have several phis, you can combine them to get zero charge. Yeah. Sorry, I wasn't clear on this. This is since W has to be... invariant. Yes, that's the. Okay, and the last term I was writing here was f mu nu dual, where f mu nu dual equals epsilon mu nu rho sigma f rho sigma is the dual of the corresponding field strength. Okay, so here, as I promised before, you can recognize this term, which is the Maxwell term, so it's the kinetic term for the gauge fields, and that's precisely the reason why we were dealing with this object, that because W alpha had F mu nu as one of its components, so W alpha was a renormalizable coupling that precisely has as a part of the of its F term gives you the F mu nu. And the other term we have here, this is a kinetic term for the gauginos. The gauginos also, which are the partners of the gauge bosons, they need a kinetic term, and they get it from this term, from W alpha, W alpha. This term is a part of D, and now D will be an auxiliary field, as I promised, and look, that is behaving as that, because D only appears here as quadratic, and in here, it appears only D times something. So it doesn't have any kinetic term, it doesn't have a propagator. So D again will be an auxiliary field in the same way that F was an auxiliary field for the chiral superfield. And the last term is this one, F mu nu dual. Probably you're not very familiar with this type of terms, but this is a term that, so it's, if you include the Einstein, the Maxwell term in your action, you have to include this one because they have the same order. But however, since you have F mu nu dual, you can prove that this term is a total derivative. So a total derivative usually is not important in when you do perturbation theory. However, for QCD and when you deal about non-perturbative physics, this will be very important. And when you talk about instantons and so on, this will be very important. So at the moment, this is just a total derivative. But it's nice that the whole thing just comes naturally from the term W alpha W alpha. Plus complex conjugate, of course. Question? Yes?
Can you give us an expression for the trace of a product of four sigma matrices? Sigma mu, sigma bar nu, sigma lambda, sigma bar next index? Because the trace is occurring in, when we try to verify this. And
yes.
How to handle that?
Okay, well, not from the top of my head now, but we can discuss it later. Yes, there was some technical things. And using, you know, the sigmas are, we know what they are, so we know the products, so we know the anti-commutators and so on. So that can be dealt with, yes. Yes, but it's a very technical thing at the moment. Yeah. Question, yes?
There's no term only F.
Oh, that's a good question. Why is it that we don't have F tilde mu nu times F tilde mu nu? Good. Because that is essentially the same as this one. So multiply this times epsilon, then you use the product of epsilon, then you have FF. Yeah. Yes. Good point. Yes. Yes. Okay, so we have considered all the terms except for the very last one, which is here the Fajaylopoulos term, and of course the Fajaylopoulos, the D term of this is, for this you require a lot of calculations, of course, and that is giving you slightly. So there's nothing, it's just the D term of V, which is D. Okay, so we are done. And so what is it, what we did when we had the whole, so the whole Lagrangian will be the sum of this term plus that term plus this term. And what is it that we did in the case of the chiral superfield Lagrangian is that out of the whole Lagrangian we extracted the part that depended only on the auxiliary field, and then we eliminated the auxiliary field from its field equations and then plug it back. Okay, we're going to do exactly the same here. So now, notice that D is an auxiliary field and doesn't have propagator, so we can eliminate it. And each term of the Lagrangian contributes to D. This is linear, this is quadratic, and this is linear. So again, the Lagrangian for the auxiliary field will be quadratic, the corresponding path integral will be a Gaussian, and it can be done exactly. So LD is a Q over 2 plus 1 half D square. plus psi times d. And so the field equation just vary this with respect to d. So that will tell you excuse me?
Should there be a mod phi squared in the Q over there? So should it be Q over 2 times D times mod phi squared?
Thank you very much. This one. Yes, thank you. It's because of this term. Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. So, this tells you that D equals to minus psi minus q over 2 times phi square. And then substitute this back. So what we get is the is similar to what we had for the F term, is that we plug into here. So we'll get, this will be 1/2 d square given that, and this one will give you another contribution. So at the end, this will give us 1/2 psi plus 1/2 q phi square. And what will this be? This will be a term that will depend on the scalar component of the chiral superfield and not on its derivatives, so that is a part of the potential for the field phi. Okay. So okay, so actually, when you do this, you will get a minus sign. So, minus acting minus that in the Lagrangian, that will give you plus that in the potential. Okay, so that means that we can have a total scalar potential in general. Have a total scalar potential and that I will write it like this just to not confuse this V with the V of the vector superfield, that again is unfortunate that they are both called V, and this will be a V coming from the F term part of the potential plus V coming from the D part of the potential, and this will be equal to what we have here was dW d phi square and what we have here is this piece, this one. And again, notice that similar to the only F term piece, this is the sum of two positive terms. So this is actually semi-positive definite. So this is a curious property that we will see is not by chance. So in the sense that the energy in global supersymmetric theories is positive. So you can see that the potential is the sum of two positive terms. Yes?
When you include more than one field?
If you have more than one, exactly. That's when you have more than one field. So this will be sum of the defies, and this is the sum of the charges times defies. So probably I should write it like this. If you want to have the general case. Okay. So this is a very important result, and it's one of the things that we will be using a lot, is the scalar potential, because the scalar potential, remember, that defines the vacuum of your theory. You have to, given a potential, you have to, given a theory with a potential, you have always to look at the minimum of the potential that will give you the configuration of minimum energy, and from that, you perturb around that. So it's always very important to know what the potential is, and in this case, we know it, and we have a lot of information, in particular, that it is positive semi-definite. Okay, so this is it. So this essentially finishes the super QED part. So we have the whole Lagrangian, kinetic terms, and couplings of fermions to bosons, and the scalar potential. So that's essentially the whole thing, and it comes out as supersymmetric in a supersymmetric matter. So before moving to another chapter, I would like to make two comments. One is that this Lagrangian that I wrote for you here as a D term, as an F term, can be written. You can write that as an integral on superspace. And that is nice because we know that, for instance, the action in, well, it's generally the integral of over space time of the Lagrangian, and here it would be nice to see we can write this as an integral also on the theta components, and this can be done easily. So the action as a superspace integral well, without supersymmetry, we know that the action is the integral of the Lagrangian over space-time. And for SUSY, we have to see we can actually use that information to write it in terms of an integral over the whole superspace. And for that, to record following is that d2 theta equals to 1, and d4 theta bar equals to 1. And essentially, any other combination will be zero, because remember that the integral of d theta itself was zero. It's only when you have saturated that you get it to be 1 in this case. So that means that if we write the Lagrangian like the D term of a Keller potential plus the F term of a superpotential plus the F term of a W alpha W alpha. You add it like this. Notice that the D term is precisely the term that has theta, theta, theta bar, and the F term is the term that has theta, theta, and it's precisely the two things that we have over there. So we can write this like the integral over D4 theta of K plus integral of D2 theta of W, because this is an F term, this has only theta thetas, plus complex conjugate, plus integral of W alpha against, D2 theta. And if we want to add a Phi A Leopoldus term, we can just add again an integral over D4 theta of the Phi A Leopoldus term. Okay. This is nice because we are used to have the actions as integrals, and this is just precisely the integral on superspace. Interesting thing to note is that there's a big difference between the Keller potential and the superpotential, in the sense that the Keller potential you integrate over the whole superspace, whereas the superpotential you integrate only on half superspace. Okay. The same thing with W alpha, W alpha. So whenever you have holomorphic functions, you have the integral is only on half superspace, and the real part, you have the integral over the whole superspace. Okay, so to conclude, this this part, let me just write the most general let me just add something which is non-abelian generalization. And in that sense, e to the v prime equals e to the minus I lambda dagger e to the v e to the I lambda phi prime, of course, equals e to the minus I lambda times phi, but W alpha equals a bit more complicated, minus 1 d bar d bar e to the minus 2v d alpha e to the 2v, and in this case W prime alpha equals okay. So this is essentially just the same thing that we had for this abelian case. We just generalize it to a non-abelian case. This is, I'm just not writing it for completeness, but not there's no. Not much content into that because we are not going to use it just for completeness. And the Lagrangian, when you write W alpha, this will have to be written as the trace of W alpha, because now W's transform as a um, in terms of the W's transform from the gauge symmetry. Okay, so having that, so let me just write the general Lagrangian, which is a coupling gauge fields to matter fields in n equals to one supersymmetry. And so most general action that is, first of all, the most general action will depend on four objects, chi, which is a function of chiral fields, e to the v and phi, and it will depend also on the superpotential, which will be a function of all the phi i's, and then it will depend on the gauge kinetic function, which is a function of all the phi i's, only holomorphic, and on the Fayet-Leopoulos term, psi. Okay? So this is the action will be determined in a supersymmetric theory. You have to give these four things. This is a number, so it's not complicated. This is a holomorphic function, another holomorphic function, and a real function. Given these objects, you can construct the most general supersymmetric action for n equals to 1. And this will be equal to the integral d4x d4 theta of k plus psi v plus integral d4x d2 theta of W plus F W alpha plus Hermitian conjugate. Okay.
Sorry.
Yes? Exactly. Absolutely true. This only for U1 factors. So I haven't told you what the gauge group is. So the gauge group can be any product of simple factors, SUN, cross SUM, and so on. Only the U1 factors have a corresponding Fayet-Leopoulos term. All the non-abelian factors do not have Fayet-Leopoulos term. Thank you for that. And the reason is clear here, because V itself transforms. In electromagnetism, the photon is chargeless, whereas the gluon is charged, or the W bosons and so on. So the same thing here. So this will be, the D term of V will be chargeless for a U1, for electromagnetism, but it will not be gauge invariant for a non-abelian group. And so that you cannot write this in your Lagrangian, because the Lagrangian has to be gauge invariant.
Excuse me?
Yes?
Are we not involving lambda negas in the W transformation on the top wall in the middle? You're saying W prime is...
Yes. Yeah. It's like this, because remember W is holomorphic. W is chiral. So at the end, this thing has to be chiral also. Precisely, because lambda dagger would be a function of phi dagger. And phi dagger is anti-chiral.
Ah, okay.
Yes. Yes, good point. Yeah. So it has to be something chiral at the end.
Can psi be of either sign?
Either sign, yes.
So there's an important thing when you are greater than or equal to 0 when it's minus.
Well, no, because it's inside a square.
Yes, exactly.
But yes, the important thing is the relative sign.
It's away from pi equals zero. It's away from 1 pi squared equals zero.
Yes,
when,
yes.
When psi is negative.
Exactly. But it's, the important thing is the relative sign between psi and the, because the charge can be negative also. Yes. So the relative sign is important when you want to find solutions. When the potential is zero, then they have to they can cancel each other. Otherwise, you don't find solutions. Yeah, that's a very good point. Okay, so this is the most general Lagrangian we can write, and so we have it all. So we have all n equals to 1 supersymmetry, global supersymmetry coupling, all the fields that we are interested in, matter fields and gauge fields. What is it that we can do now? We can do something which is very strong, is to study how these objects K, W, F, and Psi change under quantum corrections. That is the power of supersymmetry, is that it is very well behaved under quantum corrections. We can just only get a bit of the surface of the power of these results, but I will try to give you a taste of what it is. And this refers to what is called the non-renormalization theorems. So the statement is, since we know that the whole Lagrangian will depend on Keter potential, superpotential, gauge kinetic function, and the Fayet-Leopold term, we want to see how they behave under quantum corrections. So the question is, how K, W, F, and Xi behave under quantum corrections. I will just state the result and a bit of the history, and I will give you the proof next class, because we have only 6 minutes. But let me just start with this. The claim is as follows. K gets corrections order by order. In perturbation theory. That's the statement. So nothing surprising about K. Like any field theory, you get corrections order by order in perturbation theory. F. There's something very strong about F. F only gets corrections out one loop. It's only one loop corrected, and after one loop, no corrections. Okay, so that's okay, so you can do two loops, three loops, and so on. You know the loop expansion in field theory. Yes. So you can go to any order in perturbation theory, any loops, and from two on, F will not change. You have F at tree level, you do the one loop correction, you can get the correction at one loop, and after that, there are no corrections. You get the exact result in perturbation theory. So this is very, very, very strong. At the basis of this result is that F is holomorphic. So holomorphicity plays the role, and it makes the difference between F and K. K is non-holomorphic, it gets all corrections. F is holomorphic, and it's only corrected at one loop. W which is also holomorphic, is not renormalized at any order in perturbation theory. So it's even stronger than this. So you give it a three level, that's it. That's your W. So the superpotential doesn't get any corrections in perturbation theory. Okay. Okay, so this is the strongest statement. And, similar to, we can say the same thing for phi also. But psi is just a number, so it's not a big deal. But the strongest statement I'm making, and this is the one I will try to give you a taste of how it is proven next time, is for W, because this is one of the strongest results in supersymmetric theories, is that W, you give it a true level, and doesn't get corrected. So you know that it's exact to all orders in perturbation theory. It doesn't mean that it doesn't get corrected. It will get corrections, but the corrections will be non-perturbative. So it's only when you have to go to non-perturbative quantum effects to get corrections to phi. But in perturbation theory, W of phi is exact. So there are no one loop, no two loops, no three loops, no any loops of perturbation theory corrects W. And this is where we know the best about supersymmetric theories. And so, since I have just 2 minutes, I'll just tell you the history a bit. And the history of this... this was in the 1970s, I think, 1970s... in the 1977, the work of Grisaru and collaborators, Rochek and Siegel, they proved this result, in particular the non-normalization of the superpotential, by using a technique which is very technical, which is called supergraphs. Supergraphs is that it's a generalization of Feynman diagrams for superfields. So you can have a Feynman diagram where the different lines and legs and so on will not be just fields, but just whole superfields. So for that, people develop a whole industry of how to define a supergraph, how to do calculations with supergraphs, and then using that, this Grisaru, Rochek, and Siegel, they were able to prove the non-normalization of the superpotential, for instance, in 1977. So some of you were not yet alive, I guess, but it's not that far. However, the thing that we're going to use now... Oh, I'm sorry. And the result that they found is that the quantum corrections... They say quantum corrections... only come as corrections in your action which involve the full superspace. And then you say, well, the superpotential is not in the full integrated over the whole superspace, and the gauge kinetic function is not. The only exception is the one-loop correction, except the one-loop correction of F. Okay, so that's how they arrive at the result. They look for all quantum corrections, and all the corrections look like this. So, reading the Lagrangian, okay, that was 1977. In 1993, you were still alive, or you were already alive. So, 1993, Seiberg came out with a nice set of arguments using just symmetries. It's based, important, based on a string theory arguments from Witten in 1985. Based on these arguments, Seiberg was able to prove these results only using symmetry arguments and holomorphicity. And that is what we're going to do next time. So we'll start. I'll give you, for a simple model, I will prove you why W doesn't get renormalized by using Seiberg techniques, just 1993. So we're getting closer to today. So this is a nice set of arguments, simple and very powerful. So I will try to give you a taste of what they are. Okay, so see you Monday.